It is a great pleasure to welcome to European Investing Summit 2020, Arif Karim, Senior Investment Analyst at Ensemble Capital. I'm sure everyone listening will be familiar with Ensemble. They have a great investment team, and we've been fortunate to have their team members at our online conferences in the past, and I'm very excited to have Arif joining us today. Before Ensemble, Arif was a senior investment analyst and co-portfolio manager at Kilimanjaro Capital. He also was a senior equity analyst at Pacific Edge Investment Management and research associate at Robertson Stephens. Arif graduated from MIT with a BS in economics. He's also a CFA charter holder. Welcome, Arif. Look forward to your presentation. Please go ahead.
Hey, thanks, John. It's a great pleasure to be a presenter at the MOI European Summit. You know, we're big fans of your work and the professional network here. Very happy to be here. And today, I was hoping to talk about Ferrari, which I think is a very interesting company. Hopefully I'll share that with you in this presentation. So a little bit about Ensemble, just to start, give you some background. You've had a couple of my colleagues here before, so I'm sure some participants have seen the introduction before, but I'll just quickly go through it. We've been around for over 20 years. We're 100% employee owned. We now manage just over $1 billion in capital, most of that in our equity strategy that we run internally with our research team, almost $800 million or so. Our equity strategy is focused on a concentrated portfolio, and we focus on competitively advantaged businesses. That's what we start with. So that is our investable universe. We are intrinsic value oriented, and so we consider ourselves value investors. But in many ways, we kind of go beyond the ratios and try to, get at sort of the what's likely to be the probabilistic, cash flows over time using some, sort of explicit near-term forecasts. And that's usually about, between 5 and 10 years, followed by some conservative sort of longer-term modeling that's underpinned by our conviction in the durability of the moats that the companies that we own have. This is a slide that it's just a pictogram of sort of the way that we go about evaluating companies. We've got kind of three main areas of focus in terms of valuation. That is, the durability and relevance of the moat, the integrity and thoughtfulness of the management team, around value creation, capital allocation, culture that underpins the company to drive its mission forward. Forecastability. And by that, of course, the future is always uncertain, but we're looking for businesses where we can have good long-term confidence in roughly how durable and the path, the growth path of revenues will be, and the sustainability of margins and return on invested capital. That sort of comes together into a conviction framework that we lay out where we decide, that ultimately plays out into our portfolio and position sizing based on, kind of conviction as well as what our intrinsic value estimate ends up being for the stock and then the discount to intrinsic value. And that's those three things kind of play into how any particular company in our group, focus group, will end up manifesting its position size in the portfolio. So with that background, I wanted to cover Ferrari, really interesting company. We've owned it for, I think it's been now three, maybe 4 years. So just an outline of kind of how I'm going to tackle this today. I'll give you an overview of, the financial overview of the company. Stock, company history and kind of where its brand and legacy comes from, What makes FRAR unique, and this talk speaks to the moat characteristics of the company and why is it valuable for customers, why it'll stay relevant for them. And then talk about the business model, how we think about it and how that manifests itself into, the cash flows for the company. And then talk a bit about the value creation by the management team in going forward in extending the growth runway in the TAM, the total available market for their products and the brand. And then I'll conclude with a discussion on valuation. So with that, let's talk about the company. So this is a really unique company in that, you know, the chief marketing officer in an article, in an interview, I think this phrase kind of captures best what's at the heart of this company, which is that, you know, he says that the most difficult part of his job is to say no. And that is no to customers in selling them product, right? And this is a unique feature about FRAR, which is that they create products that are highly desirable to a certain set of customers. And, the product they make is limited in supply relative to the demand that customers have. And so in this article, it kind of went on to say, the idea of a $1.8 million car being a gift to the customer sounds arrogant, but there's a logic to it, you know? So they built 200 of the LaFerraris, which you have pictured here is the LaFerrari Spider. Which I think it was about, they made 200 of those as well. And they invite their best customers, you know, best in quotes, which is the most valuable customers, the most loyal customers, to have the opportunity to purchase one of these. And you know, the way and in offering this opportunity, all the prospects said yes. And that's not unusual about FRAR. And I'll give you an anecdote a little bit later about, you know, this sort of very this thing that I experienced very personally when I attended their premier event for the Monza SP1, SP2, which were introduced in September 2018 and went to production late last year and are currently being delivered to customers. But I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So what's really unique about FRAR is kind of that dynamic of a highly desirable product, high ASP, and a very exclusive customer set that, often looks for an opportunity to be invited, you know, to purchase one of these very expensive cars. If you look at history, Ferraris have historically been amongst the highest valued cars. This car here, so the most valuable car that has been sold at auction is a 1962 250 GTO, which is the car pictured here. It's not exactly this car, but it's the car pictured here. I think this was the second highest valued car that was sold also at 1962 250 GTO. So the most expensive one sold for nearly $50 million. I think $48 million was the exact price. And if you look at the highest 50 cars, most valuable cars sold at auction, over half of it Ferraris. You know, it's four of the top five, seven of the top 10, 20 out of the top 50 have been Ferraris. So that says something about the durability of the value of these cars. In many ways, for people that are not car people or Ferrari enthusiasts, it's hard to understand why people would pay so much money for this. But in many ways, you know, this I view this as mechanical art, right? And so just as we've seen art prices skyrocket over the last 20 years, we've seen the value of collectibles, including cars, collectible cars go up a lot as well. The fact that Ferrari has had such a long history of building collectible cars is very notable. So a little bit of business history. It was founded in 1939 by Enzo Ferrari, who himself was a race car driver and a racing enthusiast. In its more modern history, Ferrari was 90% owned by Fiat, which was founded and controlled by the Agnelli family. Both car companies, Fiat and Ferrari, have an intermingled history. We'll talk a little bit about that later, but suffice it to say that Fiat ended up helping finance Ferrari along its life and ended up with a 90% stake in the company. 10% remained with the Ferrari family. Today, the grandson of Enzo Ferrari, Piero Ferrari, still owns 10% of Ferrari. So under Sergio Marchionne, who was the CEO of Fiat for a long period of time, over a decade, Ferrari ended up being spun out as a standalone company, first in the form of 10% of the company being IPO'd in October 2015. And that was followed by an entire spin out of the company to Fiat shareholders in 2016. 24% of Ferrari stock is owned by Exor, which is the family holding company of the Agnelli family, and John Elkann, who's now the chairman of Ferrari as well, is the controlling member there. Within the Fiat group of brands, Ferrari was the crown jewel. And as many of you would know, you know, the auto industry is a very capital intensive industry with, you know, generally low margins, right? It's usually in the sort of single digit at best, low double, you know, kind of low teens sort of operating margins. But Ferrari, as you'll see, is a very different animal than that. And so within the Fiat family of companies, Ferrari was hidden amongst, you know, these other companies that were car companies that were very different in financial characteristics than Ferrari was. And so we like to say that it was a crown jewel, but it was a rough diamond in there. And when Marchionne and John Elkann, of course, decided to spin out Ferrari, the goal was to let it, you know, shine on its own. And when it was actually IPO'd, the margin characteristics were different than what it is today. But there was a plan in place to basically polish this business up now that it was on its own and kind of let it shine. You know, when the company was spun out, most of the sell side analysts that covered it were auto analysts, and to see the stock's valuation at the time, which was much above where the auto industry would be, just because I think participants in the market, investors, recognize it was very different than an auto company. This is not, I mean, as everybody knows, a Ferrari is not a car you get to take you from point A to point B, you know, like a Toyota or a Honda or a Fiat would be. It's actually a very different thing. It's more of I mean, if anything, it could be a weekend car, but it's more of a luxury good than it is a true car, auto, you know, with its utilitarian expectations. And so the market quickly valued it much higher than the rest of the auto industry. And there was this gap, you know, between kind of where auto analysts were trying to make sense of valuation and where generalists like us, you know, who look at different types of businesses may value this thing based on its financial characteristics and understanding, you know, the moat characteristics and how the business is run and the potential for it. So as a result, what we've seen over the last 5 years, 4 to 5 years, I guess it's 5 years now, is the performance of Ferrari has been basically quadruple, you know, the performance of the S&P 500, right, the market performance. And we believe that a big chunk of that outperformance was that, you know, A, the market getting to know, you know, this company and kind of the inherent potential for this company, and B, the company proving, you know, both setting goals, and there were some high goals set at the IPO, but then also beating those goals and then extending the goals. So kind of proving, you know, that really this is an IP company. It's not a manufacturing company at its heart in the way it generates value. So you can see in that period, so Ferrari and its S1 basically documented financials from 2012 to, you know, 2014, of course, went public in 15, and then we've seen their financials published since then. I kind of segment, you know, its financial history based on what we have into you know, these two buckets, kind of pre-IPO Ferrari, where we were seeing its as is, you know, financial stats, and then Ferrari stats that I've been able to get from the Fiat annual reports prior to 2012, and we've made some estimates on, you know, it's not as detailed as Ferrari's, you know, standalone performance details are. So there's some estimates involved in here, but it gives you a general idea of kind of the walk that its financials have taken, which is, you know, revenue has grown in the range of 7 to 8% consistently over that whole period. Unit shipments had grown about 4% a year. They accelerated to nearly 5%, and we think they accelerated a little bit in more recent years. It's been even faster than that. We'll talk about that a little bit. And similarly with pricing, you know, it's been, I'd say, conservative in its ASP growth, which has been on the order of 3%, but it's been sort of nudging higher over time period, and we believe it continues to nudge higher going forward. And so, you know, that's kind of fed revenue of 7 to 8%, and resulted in, you know, as the company has, management has, you know, polished the company and refined it and made it more, I'd say more efficient in some ways, but really getting at the core of the value creation of the company. We've seen EBITDA margins go from, you know, kind of the mid-teens, EBIT margins go from the mid-teens to mid-20s, and we think this goes to, you know, about 30% over time. EBITDA margins kind of went from the mid-20s, and we think this goes to about 40% over time as well. So it's been great margin expansion, which again drives that outperformance of the stock relative to the market, the S&P 500. But we think there's further room to grow over the next 5 to 10 years. So a little bit about the history of Ferrari, and in my mind, you know, I always like to kind of understand where the value of a product comes from and why customers want to buy a certain product, especially when we talk about, you know, branded products, right? And that's certainly what Ferrari is. And as we know, you know, their average selling price is on the order of $300,000, which is 10x what, you know, the average car probably sells at, right? So it tells you that, you know, there's 10x the value embedded in the IP than in the vehicle itself, roughly speaking. You know, if you look at other sports car makers, and probably the one with, you know, sort of this balance of high, you know, higher volume and accessibility and performance, I'd say is Porsche. You know, Porsche makes on the order of, I think it's about 150 to 200,000 cars, and versus Ferrari, which makes 10,000 cars, right? So it's very much a specialty car maker. Its history is intimately tied with its founder, Enzo Ferrari. He was a race car driver, kind of the early days of automotive, back in the 20s and 30s. He ended up joining Alfa Romeo's auto racing team, where he managed the team. And then in the late 30s, he basically, I believe Alfa Romeo spun out the team, but he ended up building the team into his own branded team. Branded Scuderia Ferrari. Because he was so passionate about racing, that's all he cared about. And of course, with racing back day as today, but even more so back then, racing is a dangerous sport. You know, there's some risk involved. And so there'd be a circuit of races you would do, and you'd build multiple cars because some number of cars would get totaled, you know, in the process. And with every racing season, you work to improve the car, you know, to stay competitive. And that's certainly something that Enzo was focused on. But he needed to raise money, you know, financing for his racing team. And so, you know, building these fast, you know, good-looking cars and you know, later on winning cars certainly made these cars very desirable amongst a set of, you know, wealthy people. Because he was so focused on racing, he would just build enough cars to sell to finance his next season. And that meant that there was a big disparity between the demand for these cars amongst those that had the means and the supply, you know? And so that was the heart of what we believe is today's Ferrari culture and brand, which is that, you know, it's a brand that's built on performance. It's a brand on exclusivity. Not everybody that wants one can get one. And privilege, you know, back then, you know, if Enzo didn't like you, he didn't sell you a car. It doesn't matter what you paid him, right? So you had to be on his good side. And those that actually did own a Ferrari ended up being in this exclusive club, basically. And so that club is still, we believe, the heart of what it means to be a Ferrarista. It's a network of globally privileged and successful people. The cost of entry is owning a Ferrari. What's really interesting is that, you know, there's a lot of most luxury brands have their foundation in Europe, and there's something about European culture, I suppose, that drives that. You know, this sense of legacy and craftsmanship, and then ultimately exclusivity, right? So you have several luxury brands based there, generally trading at, you know, much higher than market multiples, in part because they too are IP companies, right? To earn outsized profits and are able to return a lot of those excess cash flows to shareholders in one form or another. But there's no other supercar brand that has the same heritage that Ferrari has, which is what we think makes it unique and able to preserve its premium and its products, as well as the desirability of the product over time. And we've seen that durability in the price of collectible Ferraris that I mentioned earlier. Buying a Ferrari is the cost of entry, you know, into this. So the reason why people buy Ferraris are all over the map, you know, but they encompass multiple reasons depending on people's personality. But, you know, it's probably a true generalization that most kid boys, at least, you know, in their teenage years, at some point, you know, come across the Ferrari brand, and, you know, many have posters of their cars on their walls. And so that gets transferred with every generation, so long as cars are relevant and beautiful cars are something that kids and adults can appreciate. And for adults, especially, it's the collectability and appreciation for the experience that Ferrari brings, both in F1 racing, where it's a underpinning team of that whole race, along with a couple others. But it also is something that conveys status and success to those that own it, which is one reason why people buy it. And then those that are passionate about driving and racing, that it speaks to the performance aspects of the car, right? So there's various reasons why people buy it, reasons why they want it. But one thing that is unique to Ferrari in many ways is, like I said, the imbalance between supply and demand. So Ferrari, their corporate mantra is to undersupply the market, you know, to basically sustain pricing for the product, but as well to maintain exclusivity, right? So not only do you get this highly sought after product that you can enjoy and then resell at much higher than normal car prices, you know, the limited series cars are the ones that, you know, tend to appreciate dramatically, but they're entry-level sports cars, which entry levels, you know, 250 to 300 thousand dollars, actually euro, you know, those two don't depreciate a whole lot. You know, they sustain their values, but they may not, you know, appreciate in the way that limited models would. So it's really interesting that when it comes to limited models that, you know, Ferrari talks about those limited ones that are reserved, and they only make, you know, a few hundred of these, in total for a certain model, where they'll reserve these as gifts for their best clients. And I'll tell you an anecdote. So in 2008, so Ferrari went public in 2015, and Ferrari has worked to try to get investors to appreciate what the brand is all about and the passion that its customers have for it. But one way that it was able to share that with investors was in September 2018, they had a capital markets day where it was held in conjunction with a new model premiere. It was the Monza SP1 and Monza SP2. And that was one of these limited edition models that they reserved for their quote best customers, right? In the Ferrari family. And in the premiere, you know, the way they phrased, you know, those that would be invited to purchase one of these is it was a gift. It was a gift to their loyal customers. And as that article excerpt that I read earlier sort of indicated, it just kind of sounded weird that, you know, this thing that you're going to spend millions of dollars for, or certainly hundreds of thousands of dollars for, is seen as a gift. But in many ways it is, right? So they had this premiere. It's a big gala, big event, multimedia kind of an event, very exciting to be at. And they introduced these new cars. And we were there amongst, a few hundred customers. And they were going to do it twice, basically. So, in the end, they're going to end up building 499 of these Monza cars. Between the 2 days that they held this event, you can expect there were about 500 customers that were invited to view these cars. And then they had a reception afterwards. And where they had these cars, you can go look at them, take a picture with it. You can sit inside the car. And so I was online to sit inside the car and I was behind a customer. So I just, struck up a conversation with him. And it was this guy who was a Texan. He was an older gentleman, probably in his 60s. And I was just, chit-chatting with him. And he said he had just flown in for this event from Texas and that he was excited to be there. And so I asked him what he thought. And the next day, Ferrari was going to hold a track day for their customers that came to the event. Where and they were gonna, basically they had the whole track in Barcelona for customers only, and this particular customer owned an FXXK, which is a racetrack series kind of Ferrari. It's not street legal, and basically Ferrari was gonna organize to have his car brought over to that track and meet him there, and he was gonna fly over and he was gonna get to race his car there with a number of other customers, right? And they would have lunch and probably dinner, and they get to network with each other, and so. That's the type of thing that, also brings customers to the Ferrari family is this ability to, network with other people, peers in their group, from across the globe, and so who knows whether you get some business opportunities that come out of it or friendships that come out of it, or just shared passion racing against each other that comes out of it. But there's this sense of, this club that exists that my perception was that it's a big part of owning these Ferraris. So anyway, we chit chat and I said to him, oh, so this is a really beautiful car. You think you're going to order one? And he just turns around at me and says, what? I've already signed on the dotted line. I'm going to get one of these. And he was super excited, and I got the sense from him, I didn't pry too much, but I got the sense that, he's probably a guy that runs a business with, several hundred or thousand employees and generally a very serious kind of a guy. But the way his eyes lit up was like, a kid at Disneyland, right? Like, there's not that many things that, inspire passion in people that are busy and have a lot of responsibility. But Ferraris certainly are one of those things. And that, I think, speaks to the heart of the value proposition it brings to customers. So kind of talked about that. And so I'm going to skip over this slide. The big parts are, the experience of driving a Ferrari, the experience of being part of this club, being associated with F1 and Formula Racing. Going to track events and road events around the world, all those things are the types of value that Ferrari brings to them. And then, of course, we can't forget, one very important thing is the recognition of status, that you own a Ferrari, right? And so you are successful, of course, if you're going to be able to afford one. So in looking at Ferrari's business, they report four revenue line items. The majority of which is cars and spare parts for those cars. So that's, between 75 and 80%. It's going to be over 80% probably for 2020 because Formula One events, which is that second line sponsorship, brand licensing commercial, because the events are curtailed this year. So the revenue share that Ferrari and winnings that Ferrari is going to get from that are going to be curtailed as well. And then they make engines for Maserati. And this is a sort of a legacy contract for when it was part of Fiat. Maserati was a sister brand for more of a luxury-oriented brand, but also includes performance in its sort of luxury identity. So Ferrari was building V6 engines for Maserati. And then also the Alfa Romeo Giulia Quadrifoglio also has a Ferrari V6 engine in there, similar to that Maserati one. But the agreement ends in 2021, and so the CEO of Ferrari has indicated that they are not going to renew that agreement. They'll just repurpose the employees to building Ferraris. And then there's a financing piece that used to be a much bigger piece, but that's become much smaller, which has made Ferrari a much less capital-intensive business. For those of you that are interested, you'll see that in their balance sheet, amongst all the debt that they and it's not a lot of debt. I mean, amongst the entire debt balance on the balance sheet, a good chunk of that actually relates more to the securitized AR from customer financings for Ferraris. So the beauty of Ferrari's model is that it's a Veblen good, right? So it doesn't follow the normal characteristics of economic theory, which is that, you know, when you bring down the price of a product, there's more customers that line up to buy it. While that may indeed be true for Ferraris, that there will be more customers that buy it, their pricing premium, in order to sustain it, they limit supply, right? But the thing about Veblen goods is also that sometimes when you raise prices, it becomes even more desirable amongst your customer base. In this case, that's certainly true. Its customer base are the world's wealthiest people. Like I had mentioned, the average selling price of a Ferrari is, you know, on the order of $300,000. It's just below that now. Like this year it'll be, or last year it was just below that. This year we think it'll be above that. What that really means, in order to not disappoint too many customers that couldn't buy Ferrari, you have to raise prices in line with your customer's wealth, right? So most customers that are going to be Ferrari customers, their success and wealth is generally tied to the value of the equity they hold, either in their own private businesses or in public markets, right? The rate at which public markets have grown, the value of public markets have grown, has been in the kind of 5 to 7, 8% range. And so we believe that in order to maintain exclusivity, Ferrari has the ability to raise prices, ASPs. And it's not necessarily raising prices, you know, for like models. You add ways to raise prices, you know, through options or other value added, you know, improvements on the car. Different ways you can use it. So there's various ways to raise prices that don't particularly speak to just raising prices necessarily. But in that is this idea of pricing power, which has to grow at the rate of their customers' wealth. So as a result, so long as Ferrari is this desirable brand and they can maintain that desirability for the brand, which to us is relevance of the brand, and relevance of the product in the way they monetize that brand, you're going to have pretty high ROIC. We were first attracted to Ferrari after we went public, despite the hype. Actually, we dismissed it initially because of the hype around it, but then we were drawn to the business model when we noticed that the ROIC, after you kind of made some adjustments to the balance sheet as they were in the process of separating out the financing of the cars, you know, to other entities, was that the core return on invested capital was over 100%, which is incredible, right? I mean, this ROIC is in line with high IP companies like MasterCard or Apple or some of the technology IP companies. That attracted us to the model, take a deeper look. And when we took a deeper look, we start to understand kind of the characteristics of Ferrari that make it such a great business and a unique business. One of the important things is for management to understand where value creation comes from, and how to extend that value creation to the extent possible that, it's beneficial for, shareholders, the company and customers, right? I'd reverse that to say customers first. Because shareholders are always the residual owners of profits that come from adding value for customers. And so we tend to focus on, what are you doing for the customer that's generating the bucket of value creation that's then being split amongst customers, various constituencies around the company, and then shareholders ultimately. So that value creation, is about this exclusivity. It's about performance. It's about enjoying the experience, and it's about sustainability, right? In that, more increasingly, people around the world care about sustainability, and so, of course, hybrid technology and then full electrification is something that customers care about, and Ferrari has to bring to market. The other thing is, market extensions of the car, and we'll talk about that in more detail later, but a lot of that is sort of focused around this Ferrari SUV that the market has been talking about for a couple of years now, but Ferrari insists it's not an SUV, so it's the not SUV Ferrari, but a much more utilitarian car that extends the usefulness of Ferraris and extends the value of the brand for both existing and new customers. Management talk about favoring revenue over volume, which we take to mean that, you know, they're going to be pushing on pricing a little bit more aggressively than they have in the past, which, like I said, you know, I think there's a lot of room for that because we believe they've underpriced the cars relative to the rate at which their customers' wealth has grown, which then creates these situations where you have a lot more people that can afford a car, which then drives a situation where there's, you know, longer and longer waiting lists and or disappointed potential customers that then go somewhere else. So there's some things you can do there to improve that situation. But we think ultimately it continues to drive margins further. We've seen Ferrari become a little more aggressive in growing units. And they've grown units from 6,000 cars to 10,000 cars over the past decade. And we think that there is a sustainable way to grow, sustainable meaning a way to grow that to 15,000 and beyond without diluting the exclusivity and saturating the market with products of its brand. And therefore, you know, maintaining both new car prices, but also existing resale prices. And a big chunk of that is about extending the brand to new adjacent segments in the car market that still have performance at the heart of them, but increase the usability of the car. So, you know, how that filters down into the financial model, you know, it brings high visibility, you know, to revenues at Ferrari and production. You know, many of their cars have 12 to 24 month waiting lists. It's very common. They're usually accompanied by significant deposits that customers make up front in order to secure their orders and their place in line. Historically, 2/3 of their orders have come from existing customers, but as they grow, that may it may already have reduced from that. That number is about two years old. But as they grow, the point is to not just rely on existing customers, but also bring in new customers into the fold. And then have them become recurring customers as well over time. And so about 2/3, maybe a little bit less than that, come from existing customers. And we expect that over time, maybe that falls to maybe 50%. And so long as that mix is sustainable, it's probably a good mix to have for the company. The other notable point is that because supply is limited, because production comes in after it's bespoke tailoring of these cars that are going to be produced for the customer, right? So generally cars aren't produced until customers order them and, you know, design them and then put a deposit down. And so that makes cars and shipments resilient through recessions. And so we've just gone through two recessions where we have, you know, data for Ferrari. I'd say, you know, obviously the current one was very sharp but short-lived. Probably not enough to get customers to get to the point where they are feeling, you know, much less wealthy. But certainly the last recession we had, the GFC, had a more sustained, you know, sort of panicked portion to it, where there was opportunity for customers to cancel orders. But because of the nature of the business with exclusivity and undersupplying the market, you quickly had, you know, to the extent that you had customer cancellations, you quickly had other customers behind them who didn't get a place in line that wanted to take their place. You know, you can see that the cars sold in the 08, 09 time period, you know, didn't change much at all, you know, in terms of resiliency of the model. And we saw that again in management commentary over the last couple of quarters this time around, where they were expecting to get more cancellations, but actually didn't get very many cancellations at all. So that makes it very, so A, that speaks to the power of the brand, B, it speaks to the desirability of the product, and C, it kind of speaks to the uniqueness of the model. Very, very few models actually behave in this way. As I spoke about, they had their capital markets meeting back in 2018, where they kind of laid out the plan for the next a few years, I guess it was 2019 through 2022. In that plan, they talked about, you know, some of the targets they had, but also more importantly, the fact that they were investing in the company to extend the value of the brand of the company by extending its market, right? And so that involves investment in R&D, it involves investment in manufacturing capabilities and capacity, and then bringing to the market a production version of their hybrid and then later EV technology. All very important investment priorities. So that's caused CapEx to bump up since, you know, kind of the prior, over the prior 5 years or so, from kind of a level of, you know, the mid 300s to what's going to be about 750 million this year. And the way Ferrari views CapEx is, you know, they capitalize a portion of their R&D. And so their, you know, total CapEx number sort of divides up into half R&D that's being capitalized and amortized as the products come to market. But also half goes towards, you know, production capabilities. Ultimately, as a result of this investment, the mix that Ferrari expects to have in the types of series of cars, you know, is here on the left. And the Monza that I spoke of, which was premiering, also coincided with the premiere of this new series of cars that's going to be a regular limited series of production cars. So it's called the Icona line. And of course that stands for iconic. And these are more design oriented limited series cars as opposed to performance oriented limited series cars. So I showed a picture of the La Ferrari, which every 7 to 10 years or so, Ferrari brings out a what's called a hypercar, which is kind of their, you know, highest envelope pushing performance technology car that's come right off the racetrack, you know, as a street legal car. Usually numbers in the hundreds, and so every, you know, 7 to 10 years you get, you know, one of these, you know, that they bring in. That's their hypercars, and they'll continue to do that. But with the Icona series of cars, but that you always had gaps between, you know, these hypercars, right, lasting, you know, call it 4 to 5 years. What the Icona cars are is they're going to be limited series cars, so like the Monza, where they're going to produce 499 of these Monzas. But there'll be a regular cadence to when they bring out these limited series cars. And the heart of their the car is going to be focused more around sort of the iconic designs that Ferrari has had in the past and then pushing them into future. It's more design oriented, but still underpinned by very high performance drivetrains. And so I told that story about you know, the customer I talked to, who I thought was kind of the epitome of sort of the way to think about Ferrari and its relationship with customers. You know, he had signed on the dotted line for a Monza, I presume without really knowing exactly where the price point was going to be, right? And so, you know, I expected it was going to be kind of in the, you know, call it 850 to one and a half, you know, or what, one and a quarter sort of million range. Couple of days after the event, Ferrari basically announced that all the 499 Monzas were spoken for. And later, you know, sort of, it wasn't official, but we found out that, you know, the pricing is going to be something in the, you know, 1.8 million range for these cars. And so it just kind of goes to speak to the value these cars bring and how customers think about what they're worth, which is that they're relatively insensitive to the exact pricing range. And, you know, to say that $500,000 doesn't really matter, you know, for most people kind of blows your mind a little bit that, you know, that's a lot of money. But at the same time, you know, for the strata of customers we're talking about, $500,000 really isn't that much. And they know that the minute they receive shipment of these limited production cars, that car is going to be worth more than whatever they paid for it. And if you wait, you know, 3, 5, 10 years, it's going to be worth even more. And that's just based on the legacy of how cars have done. These limited production cars have done. And so that Icona series, you know, is this high ASP, high margin. We think it's, you know, 80% plus EBITDA margin kind of a car. And we're going to see a regular cadence of this that's going to sustain pricing. And then that GT segment, that's where the new SUV is going to fall under. And that's more of a, you know, more of a touring, more practical kind of a car. Which is going to be account for more than it does today. So at that capital markets day, Ferrari guided to 15 new models be launched from between 2019 and 2022. They've launched six, five are shown here. One other one they just announced recently was the Portofino M. So not all models they talked about are entirely new models, but the SF90 Stradale is, the Puro Sangue SUV is going to be, the A12 GTS is a new model. But, you know, the F8s are both progressions, iterations from the 488 just end of life. So, you know, the SF90 is a really interesting model to kind of look at really quickly, specifically, which is that it's the first plug-in hybrid production model, meaning it's a regular model, as opposed to the LaFerrari, which was also a hybrid car, but that's a specialized limited series model, right? But this is the first production model. And Ferrari had talked about how by the end of 2022, they expect 60% of their model lineup to be hybrids. And hybrids inherently have a higher cost to them. But Ferrari has indicated that, you know, along with bringing better environmental impacts of their cars with hybrid cars, that they also enhance performance as well. And so that gives them room to increase pricing. And so the SF90, there wasn't a comparable car in the lineup to the SF90, but where it ended up is really interesting in the lineup, in that it, you know, it's priced at a starting point of 450,000 euro, which means, you know, after options and personalization, it'll probably be more in the mid 500s. But that price point is a new price point for a production car for Ferrari. So that speaks to kind of the pricing pressure they're going to put on their cars, meaning pricing them up as they enhance their performance. And the SF90 Stradale's performance is in line with the LaFerrari, which costs, you know, multiples of what the Ferrari. So you're getting a deal, you know, relative to performance that people with LaFerraris, you know, have. But of course, it's not a limited series car, so it's not going to have the type of value, collectability value that the LaFerrari has. But it speaks to kind of the pricing strategy along with the technology evolution that Ferrari's going to have going forward. So this brings me to my final segment, which is, you know, around value enhancement of the brand and the company. So historically, Ferrari has been conservative in the number of cars they've produced because they've wanted to preserve this exclusivity, right? So they produced, you know, less than 7,000 cars a year. As Marchionne sort of, you know, was bringing it to market and then, you know, IPO'd it, definitely that there's been a little bit of a emphasis on growing production and units. In part because wealth and the number of wealthy people has grown dramatically over the last couple of decades. It's the latest wealth report I have here. There might be, you know, a more recent one, but it indicated that, you know, there were, from our read, the way we look at it, you know, there's the number of high net worth individuals that are worth 10 million or more are in from our perspective, you know, potential customers of Ferrari. And so if you look at that kind of 10,000 units they shipped in 2019 and compare it to roughly 1.8 million high net worth individuals, it ends up being, you know, a 0.5% penetration rate. Now, not every high net worth individual obviously would find spending, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars on a Ferrari as being something they want to do. But certainly much fewer want just a sports car. And so to the extent that you can address a bigger segment of that high net worth individual market with cars that still embody the Ferrari experience, the Ferrari mystique, identity, performance, that's a value enhancing thing for the brand. So at their capital markets day, Ferrari estimated, you know, they had, you know, 0.05% global penetration of 18 million high net worth individuals. Our bar is a little bit higher than that. And so we think, you know, it's about 1/10 of that. So their penetration is 0.5% amongst the 1.8 million or so, roughly 2 million, let's say, individuals that probably could buy one if they wanted to. One model to look at is this, you know, this extending the segments into which you address performance-oriented identity and culture is Porsche. I mean, they've been super successful in extending what was really a sports car identity into a family car identity as well, you know, or bringing in family car or utilitarian usages into their car lineup. And that really was done with the Cayenne and the Macan, which are their SUVs. The Cayenne was introduced in 2002. There was a lot of poo-pooing by hardcore Porsche fans at the time to bring in an SUV, you know, this hulking SUV, which has a certain reputation for drivability. But Porsche did a great job in bringing performance identity to that SUV And today, the Cayenne and the Macan, which are their, you know, regular size SUV and their mini SUV, account for about 50% of their volumes. And their volumes have gone from, you know, roughly 50,000 cars to, it looks like over 250,000 cars right now and heading towards 300,000. So with Ferrari, the rumored car they're bringing to market that's more utilitarian is this Puro Sangue, what probably will be an SUV, but we'll see what it's, what definitive, you know, sort of shape looks like. People estimate that it'll be in the $350,000 range. And we think it actually has room to be higher than that, you know, more like in the 400 to 500, but we'll see. But in terms of units, you know, the market is estimating units in kind of the, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 units range. We think that, you know, the current set of product lineup plus incremental cars outside of the Puro Sangue are going to be able to drive Ferrari's shipments, you know, to something like, you know, 12,000 to 14,000 units. Given where sort of comparable brands, in other words, expensive brands are bringing incremental SUV type units to market at, you know, higher price points, it looks like the expectations for Ferrari in terms of units for the Puro Sangue are probably low. You know, it's sub 10% at this point. We think this thing can probably be at least 20%, if not higher, over time. The latest sort of sports car brand to bring an SUV to market is Lamborghini with their Urus car, and that already is on its way to accounting for half of total units that are going to be sold. Additionally, Puro Sangue is going to be a production hybrid, and as we discussed with the SF90, it looks like Ferrari's strategy for pricing is that, you know, with better performance and the higher cost of hybrids, that they're going to pass on that cost plus, you know, their normal margin to the customer. So again, increasing our confidence that, you know, this thing will probably come in at the $400,000 to $500,000 price point. And then finally, this product is a much better fit for the Chinese market, where, you know, the wealthy there don't drive themselves because traffic, you know, is terrible, and there's this culture of being driven. And you don't get driven in a sports car; you get driven in a sedan or an SUV. And so Ferrari currently sells less than 10% of units to China, and we think that this product in of itself will be a huge booster to their ability to penetrate the wealthy in that market. So finally, talking about valuation, you know, on paper Ferrari looks expensive, but some things to think about, and we have a very bottoms up sort of DCF driven valuation model in deciding what the intrinsic value of a customer is, and then we usually take the results from that and compare it to what market valuations have been. And our valuation seems to be in line with kind of the way the market has been valuing the company. But it's an IP-based company, you know, and that IP is intangible, which means that it's low capital intensity. So it's very, very cash flow generative. And we've seen other businesses with those kinds of characteristics also have, you know, high premiums to kind of what market valuations will be. In other words, you know, so like S&P 500 type of valuation. And so, you know, and they have a strong ability to raise prices. We think that going forward, they have a higher price increase capability than they have in the past, than they've actually utilized in the past. And they have a management team there that's willing to, you know, start to experiment with how pushing that farther. And of course, with the Veblen good, the advantage is that, you know, that makes it more exclusive and it potentially brings more customers interested in this kind of a brand. And so, you know, we think that both with the higher pricing sort of lever they're going to use, as well as addressing more segments in adjacent markets that appeal to their core, to their customer base and expand their core customer base, we think that they'll be able to, you know, double revenues between now and roughly 2026 plus or minus, which will drive EBITDA margins to the 40% range, EBIT margins to about the 30% range, a little bit higher than 30%. And that drives our fair value estimate of 195 euro. And so probably the most direct comp is Hermès, we think. And as you can see that over time, as the market's gotten to know Ferrari and Ferrari's proven its ability to raise prices and grow its unit shipments, grow margins, that its own valuation has also been creeping higher as well. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you for listening. And I look forward to being in touch with anybody that wants to discuss Ferrari, and would love to hear any feedback.
Arif, thank you so much for such a terrific in-depth presentation. We are pretty much out of time, but maybe just a question on John Alcan and whether Exor has given any indication of their intentions for their Ferrari stake.
No, as far as I know, they intend to hang on to it. I haven't seen, I haven't come across anything that would say differently. This Ferrari has been a part of his family business, you know, the Fiat, you know, the Agnellis, right, within the Fiat business for since the 60s, I think it is. There's a great movie, Ford versus Ferrari, that's very entertaining, but also talks a little bit about this, you know, dynamic of how Ferrari ended up becoming part of Fiat. But yeah, there's no indication that Exor is looking to divest any material portion of Ferrari shares.
We live in a world of electric vehicles. Any take on that trend vis-a-vis Ferrari? Anything we should be aware of there?
Yeah, I talked about, you know, our focus on both moat durability and relevance. We think the moat's very durable. The thing that electrifying cars brings is that relevance piece to it, right? And at the core of the Ferrari experience is driving the car and, you know, the way it handles, the sounds, you know, all these kinds of things. And of course, electrification, it's quiet, right? And so certainly there's a challenge. So Ferrari's, working on the technology to get to electrification. They've talked about, you know, potentially having a car sometime post 2025. We think that's a reasonable timeline. They're getting to electrifying, in other words, hybrid, you know, cars, over the next few years, with this goal of 60% electrification hybrid cars in their model lineup by 2022. So we think at some point you do end up with an electric Ferrari. The challenge for them is that driving a car under EV is still something that's an experience driving experience-filled, you know, driving experience for customers. But the other is also that customers care to drive their own cars versus, you know, autonomously drive cars, right? So those are definitely things to look out for as being threats to the model and the value of the brand. But thus far, it's just too early to know. We think Ferrari is aware of that, and they're working on ways to address that.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I'll just encourage our members to feel free to follow up with you with any further thoughts or questions. Once again, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and present such an in-depth case on the company.
Of course, I was happy to. Thanks so much for inviting me, and I look forward to interacting with other members about this. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Goodbye for now.
Okay, bye.